Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Mike.
What are we drinking tonight?
We got Whiskey Sours with Rebel Yell Bourbon, which until today, I had never tried, but we'll see how this works out.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And how many trips to the store did you make for all the ingredients?
Three. Despite my intensive list making, I forgot lemons and limes, and I then forgot the cherries, which were the last thing we stopped for, and that's why we were late. Okay.
So I'm Nathaniel, your host here for Bikers, Dice, and Bars, and sitting with me, as usual, to my left is...
Just Jacob.
Now, we are actually down a host today. Dr. Xander Gerrymander could not make it, and in his place, we have brought two of our regular friends, our Monday Night Gaming Group, in fact.
I am Mike Toussignant.
Christina Riot.
Now, Christina is one of the oldest friends of mine in this town. One of the first people that I met for my gaming group when I moved here back in 2005.
And Xander.
Yeah, and Xander. Yeah. We more or less met around the same time for a different game that we'll talk about sometime when both of you are on. But since Xander can't make it today, unfortunately, we'll have to save that for another time. So we play in a gaming group on Monday nights, and I'm really glad that I could get both of you here into the studio. Oh, is there no whiskey in this?
There is, pouring whiskey but there's in just after not the enough.
Fact? Not enough.
Okay, well, I'm always down with more whiskey.
They're all right. I went with the safe recipe, and I think they undershot the whiskey on that.
All right, so tell us a little bit about the safe recipe of this.
I Googled it and made a couple of tweaks.
Well, it smells really good.
Yeah, so let's see. I started with fresh lemon and lime juice. I squeezed about 7 ounces of lemon, 2 ounces lime. There's whipped egg whites, Rebel Yell, which, I tried it by itself. It's all right. As I've said before, I'm a bit challenged by bourbon, but it definitely seemed like something that would fit well in a cocktail.
I've never had Rebel Yell before. Any of you?
Nope.
Nope. First time for me.
It is strictly mid-shelf.
Rebel Yell, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Handcrafted according to the original time-honored recipe since 1849. The award-winning American whiskey that honors the rebel in all of us. Are you rebel enough?
Well, with the Rebel Yell, I cried more. Or Mo.
Is there a questionnaire so I can find out whether I'm rebel enough or not?
We brought on a pair of our regular gaming group as guests here, and one of our things is when we bring on a guest, they got to bring the drink. And Whiskey Sour, I'm happy, is one of my favorite go-to beverages. It's kind of my default when I go to a bar. If I don't know the bar, I always test a Whiskey Sour. You know, it's always a good standby. They got the sour on the gun. They usually have whatever their crappy whiskey is. But usually I can just get a Whiskey Sour, can see how strong the bartender makes it. And then that for me is like a guide sign for how good this bartender is going to be.
As someone who can't tolerate really sweet sour mix, I'm not that brave. That's not my test drink. But I totally understand where you're going from. And in theory, I'm with you.
Now, to bring it back to our first episode, Jacob, you've also brought as a back here some Old German.
Old German.
This seems to be quickly becoming the official drink of our podcast, because I think in almost every episode now, I've had an Old German before we started.
Although it's not officially the official drink, Old German, if you'd be interested in becoming our sponsor, please contact Nathaniel.
Anybody at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company listening? Let us know. Whiskey Sours. I don't know. I've been drinking these for years, and I'm really excited.
I do have to say, I'm assuming that you're with me on this. I'm not a big fan of the sour mix. I generally, if they're going to pull it off the gun, I'm just not going to order, because it just feels weird in my throat. I don't know if anyone else has that problem where it like kind of, I don't know if it's the sugar content or what it is, just makes everything feel dry and scratchy and raw. So just fresh lemon and lime. Otherwise,
fresh lemon and lime.
Simple syrup.
I've never had it fresh lemon and lime and simple syrup at a bar. It's always been on the gun. So I have to be on the lookout for that now.
a place that's going to be more dedicated to making fancy cocktails will do that. But like your average dive bar isn't going to be like, oh, hold on, let me go squeeze you, sir, 8 different lemons for your little frou-frou drink.
Oh, that the Secret Society is that's a bar that is also like a venue for shows, right?
Yeah.
They make them fresh.
Yes.
And they're very good.
Yeah.
And in fact, I am quite certain our absentee host sometimes DJs there.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Does other things. Yeah.
Dr. Gerrymander is probably going to be pissed for missing this episode.
Nice.
That's a good place.
Sorry, Xander.
I danced to some ska there not that long ago.
Ooh. Yeah, no, I went and saw the Libertine Bells there just recently, and it was a great show.
Fantastic. I don't know where we're at now.
Give me a little bit more. In this cup,
I don't even remember what I poured in here.
No, just pour me some whiskey in here to kind of balance out the sour mix.
Yeah. So that was a sight unseen mix. That was a little. That's why I was like, right, take a little more whiskey.
What are your two's feelings on rum?
I love rum.
I think rum. I don't like rum.
It
makes me sick.
What types of rum?
Oh, I have no idea.
Okay, there's the brown rum. There's the clear rum.
Clear.
Okay. What about spiced rum?
Ooh.
Spiced.
I don't know if that'd be your spiced.
Captain. That'd be your Captain Morgan.
Captain Morgan or Kraken or any of the. Huh?
No, okay. I haven't had much rum.
So the next time you're on, I will do Key West sours.
I mean, if I'm drinking like hard alcohol, I'm mostly drinking Jaeger. So I don't have much experience.
Jaeger. Wow, I'm having a flashback to the last character jam.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, where Xander's character had a cybernetic implant. No, a biotic. Something changed in his body that made every liquid that he ingested transform to Jägermeister in his stomach.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, and surprisingly.
What did you just throw into my cup here?
Oh, it's a little twist of. Whatever this
citrus is. It's a treat.
It looks and smells like a miniature grapefruit.
It's a zest.
So
it's
we
a
had
grapefruit
two of
zest.
These in the fridge like a week ago. And I was like, what the hell are these? And Christina was like, I think they're oranges. But
remember, you're not fully clean unless you're zestfully clean. somebody got
zestfully
that.
Clean.
Ding. Now that we're hitting the road, let's talk about our first topic, bicycle clubs. You know, I think everybody who's listening has probably read about the Hell's Angels and watched Sons of Anarchy and is familiar with the concept of MCs, motorcycle clubs. However, something that a lot of people don't think about is that there are clubs for all different kinds. There are scooter clubs, there are moped clubs, and of course, there are bicycle clubs. And I understand that our guests today, just one, if not both of you, are members of a bicycle club.
That is correct. Yeah, again, my name is Mike Tussignant, and I'm a member of the Dropout Bike Club out of Portland, Oregon. We've been around since 2005, currently sort of on a sabbatical right now because it's been a long, busy few years. So we've just been building freak bikes, usually out of recycled parts, upcycled parts, broken bikes, non-functional things that are bike-related or not bike-related. Anything you can weld together and then pedal somewhere, that's kind of our wheelhouse.
Anything that can make a mess in the garage.
Well,
so as a bike club, then, do you have a communal garage where everybody gathers together and works?
Yes, we do. In the past, we've had a spot at the Portland Autonomous Zone down on 17th or 16th and Woodward, 17th and Woodward. We were there for several years. Before that, we were at the Watershed, which is another large communal workspace up on Milwaukee. So again, we've been around for about 13 years. As of right now, we have pulled out of PAS for various reasons and are kind of in a temporary spot. You've seen that a lot of our equipment is down in my garage right now until probably around October, and then we might be able to move into a bigger space.
So wait, so most of that equipment in your garage is your club stuff?
Well, that giant gas rig right there in the corner and the welder that's usually there belong to Carl personally, but I mean, we all use it.
Carl being a member of the club.
Yes. So it's sort of communal slash individually ours. Like a lot of the stuff in the back room is mine. It's hard to really draw a line of whose is what anymore. It's just all been together for so long, you know.
So as someone who grew up around motorcycle clubs and motorcycle groups, I don't quite understand. Give me a rundown on the culture that goes along with being in a bicycle club.
So that's kind of a broad question. I mean, just like in any other club situation, if you're going to wear patches on your back, we're not a three-piece.
Are there three-piece
clubs?
There
are absolutely three-piece clubs. There's the Dead Baby Bike Club based out of Seattle. They are, I think they'll be celebrating their 21st this year?
Something 1996, like that. 22nd,
actually, I think. They've been holding it down with big numbers up there and in Vancouver, BC, and to some degree for the last 7 to 8 years in Portland also. There are clubs all over the country. There's Skull back in Boston, who's been out there for untold years also. Midnight Riders and Black Label in Minneapolis.
I'm familiar with Black Label, so.
Yeah, they're pretty rad. And the Rat Patrol, who is international, they're all over. Always been friends as well. And there's tons of clubs down in California and the Southwest. Lots of lowrider guys out there.
Yeah. Lowriders?
Oh, yeah.
Bicycles?
Absolutely.
Tell me more.
I'm not super well versed in that. They often are more like those custom shop kind of dudes that aren't doing their own work. They're not fabricating frames and stuff necessarily. Again, this is a broad statement. Don't want to say that it's true of everybody. But there's a lot more money spent on paint jobs and, you know, Springer forks and things like that than there are on innovation or problem solving on the fly.
So kind of like the difference between a tuner versus a showroom quality whip.
Yeah. So I think some of that is kind of tied into it being a much flatter area once you get into like Vegas has had the OBC, the Outlaw Bike Club thing in April for, I don't know, at least a decade or so. And that is a lot of just flat runs on lowriders, which obviously is impractical here or in Seattle.
Right.
We have so much fiction and movies and books and comics and stories and television about MCs, but nobody ever thinks about an outlaw bike club, an outlaw bicycle club.
It's obviously modeled off of MCs. It's not an original concept. I think a lot more than probably started springing up, like you said, since Sons of Anarchy has happened, that is definitely a point of contention and makes it a little more difficult for, you know, groups that have been around for longer to have any legitimacy. Because I know we've obviously had some interactions with MCs and stuff in the past, and we're generally on good terms with everybody. But sometimes, like, if, for example, I've met up with a group of Free Souls one time and someone was a little drunk and giving them a hard time.
That would be another bike club?
No, the Free Souls MC.
Okay.
Yeah. They are present in this town and they're pretty rad, but there was a drunk person on, I don't remember if it was our ride or someone else's ride, but they were just like being an asshole at the bar at this dive in Southeast, and they were not taking kindly to it, and they saw all these patches, and me and another member of the Dropout Club talked to a couple of the Free Souls. Everything was cool. Then drunk dude started yelling at them. We were like, no, dude, he's not with us.
Wow.
Threw him out. We were like, we left some beers at the bar for you. Because, you know, very much they have a spiel, too, for any time they see people with, everyone wants to put a patch in their back if they've seen Sons of Anarchy and whatnot.
Yeah. Oh, God,
So that's, and it's a blessing and a curse because it, you know, gives a little bit of a, I guess, a kind of a cliff notes of what that's about, but it's also sensationalized. So people have skewed views of what an MC is.
Christina.
Yes.
What's your involvement in the club?
Support, mostly. I didn't really know much about bicycle clubs until I met Mike. Well, that's not true because I knew Carl before, but really my introduction was through Mike, and I've been on lots of rides. It's not really a culture that fits in my lifestyle, but I can see how it is attractive to a lot of people. I don't know. There's a lot of drama involved. there is a lot of drama. And I think that, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who get involved for the wrong reasons because, like Mike said, you know, it's sensationalized and they don't really know. You know, I think there are a lot of people who have been in the community for a long time and represent it well. But I think things have changed quite a bit.
Yeah. In Portland, I've only been in town for 8 years or so and only been hanging out with Zubom and the other bike clubs and bike community for probably 6 or 7 of those years. Even since then, I've seen a lot of change. Like, obviously, many people have grown up. New people come around with different ideas of what they want a community to be. And, you know, there's always that kind of friction. it's an interesting community. I'm super glad I found it because everyone in it is looking for something. No one's there because they're whole.
Yeah. Well, that's like, going to be the same with pretty much any kind of social club, be it a super exclusive rich one or kind of a down and DIY bike culture thing.
Yeah. Everyone there is looking for something. And I know for me, part of it was, there's all these cool people doing crazy stuff. But for me, I wanted to learn how to weld and make crazy shit and help people have a good time.
Yeah, I think it absolutely, for some people, it's a status, it's an ego, it's, a way to stick out and be known. And unfortunately, though, I think social media is part of the change that we've seen, I think. And I am curious to see or to know if that's so with a lot of different types of clubs, if social media has changed the dynamic of many groups and many communities, because it really changes the original intent of groups and clubs that come together. It just adds this level that really doesn't need to be there and complicates things and really involves those egos and status even more so and inflates all of that in a negative way.
I understand that you made a website for the bike club.
I did.
What level of interaction has that website had on their social media presence? And do you feel that that website has contributed to positive change on the social front?
Well, let me say that was the goal, was to kind of, the website, for me, when I made the website, I was thinking that it would help to focus people on the club and what they're about and the community. But really, if it's not Facebook, people aren't on it. People aren't using it. I made forums, and it's a really beautiful website, in my opinion, because I made it. But people don't go there because it's not Facebook. And who are they? They want to impress 300 friends, and on the website, there's like a minimal amount of people, and it's not accomplishing what they want.
I got one question when it comes to the dropouts. I mean, as someone who has spent a big chunk of their life in the motorcycle culture, I know that other bicycle clubs in some areas have had to go before the Council of Clubs in order to get their patches approved and such.
That sounds sinister.
It's protocol and it's good manners.
It is good manners. And let me tell you, it'll save you an ass whooping.
Yeah.
Okay. Did the dropouts have to do that, or is the Portland free zone?
Okay. No, the Portland autonomous zone is a whole other story.
Well, no, I specifically meant, okay. So the Portland.
How deep on this rabbit hole do we want to go?
Be prepared to cut this out. But the Portland free zone is a reference to the fact that Portland is a free travel zone for a lot of 1%, 1%er clubs. They can pass through town wearing colors without it being an issue as long as it doesn't say Portland on it.
Right. So regarding the Portland double, the bottom rocker, obviously we're a one piece club. We just rock dropout. Mm-hmm. And that is largely indicative of, we take ourselves seriously, but not that seriously. I mean, we're a bunch of grown ass people riding around on tall bikes and shit. So we're not looking to ruffle feathers or anything, but we don't wear a Portland bottom rocker. It's been cleared in the past because it has been approached with clubs in town. But for example, the Dead Babies wear a Nowhere bottom rocker because they were absolutely told they can't because they share colors with the Angels.
Mm-hmm. The question I have is that in motorcycle clubs, you have a lot of veterans show up. How's that in your world?
I don't know how deep I really want to get into that because there is a lot of history that happened about 5 or 6 years ago. I would say it's very rare other than, it's probably been a couple of years. There have been 6 active members up until recently. A lot of the others have moved away or distanced themselves because there were events with previous members that I want to get too far into many years ago.
Totally understand.
But it's an ongoing drama.
I'd like to bring this back to something that you mentioned earlier that our listeners probably don't know anything about. That's this fantastic magical word called Zubom.
Zubom?
Zubom!
Yes, sir. So Zubom has been around longer than Dropout has, or as far as I know, Chunk 666 and Zubom are the oldest outlaw-type bike club things happening in Portland. So I believe this year will be the 16th anniversary of Zubom in August. 2000. Nice. 2003, depending on who you talk to.
What is Zubom?
So Zubom, every Sunday night for the past 15, 16 years, a bunch of people have been getting together on mostly kids' bikes in the last decade or so. Freak bikes, regular bikes, non-functional bikes, shopping carts, skateboards. And we go up into the West Hills, we take the Max, and we just ride down through Washington Park and various other places at high speeds at night. And it's awesome. We do it as many times as we can, and we hang out.
And it's a straight downhill ride, right? For the most part?
There are so many different ways to get down. You can take a long, slow ride that'll take you a half an hour. You can get down in 8 minutes if you take Highway 26.
But what is... Okay. Is there a traditional bomb?
So there is what is called new bomb, which is basically how we start every night for as long as I've been around. There's a run called OG, which is a bit longer and flatter. But yeah, I would say new bomb is the standard first run.
Now, is Zubom in any way related to that big old stack of bikes that is in downtown?
Absolutely it is. So a decade ago in 2007.
In Portland, Oregon.
A really interesting documentary. Side note, if you go to Movie Madness has a copy, there might be some others floating around, is Veer, which is a documentary about Zubom.
Can you spell that?
V-E-E-R. That was 2000, I think that was 2006, 2007. You get to see a lot of like the OGs of Zubom, the Sprockets, like old dropouts Sprockets and stuff.
Yeah, I know the Sprockets.
And just so it follows like some legislature of like bike rights laws that went into the books around that time. It goes into the dedication of the pile. Because before that, let me go back because you asked about the statue. So the statue is the Zubom pile. It's the Portland People's Bike Library. And I am the librarian of it, or at this point, one of three librarians because we're sharing it now. But yeah, so we meet there every Sunday at 8:30. We ride at 9. If you need to borrow a mini, we have upwards of 8 to 15 to 20 or more at any given time that we can loan out, and you can ride with us.
And the bikes at the pile are there to loan, right?
Yeah, that's the People's Bike Library. Those are available to anyone that wants to use one. Up on a Sunday night.
I'm just about to, you're reading my mind here. I'm like, we should have a Biker's Dyson Bar's Zubom night.
That would be good because right before the drunk driver hit me, I was due to go up there and borrow a friend's gravity racer.
Nice.
To go down. He insisted I'd go down the OG first, but yeah, it was, I took that out on the straight and it was wicked.
Mm. Christina, you Zubom?
No. I'm a chicken.
What? I thought you were hardcore.
She is not.
Riot
she's
not is hardcore.
She's a mother.
I am not hardcore.
I thought you were a riot.
No.
Riot's hardcore, just not in that way.
Not in that way. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Okay.
So my mom has been to Zubom and Christina hasn't.
I've heard of this thing where you go to Lad's Edition and ride around the circle on tall bikes for like 5 hours or something.
So, well, that doesn't require tall bikes. The Lad's 500 is this Saturday.
Ooh.
Is happening at Lad's Circle. Yeah, Dave Barstow is running that. This will be the third year running. This is the third first annual.
So, and by the time this podcast airs, that will have been like two days ago.
Oh, yeah, my bad.
Well. Oh, yeah. So it was a great time, man. It was a blast. I'll tell you what. But yeah, so he's been doing that for 3 years now. We did show up. Dropo did show up and do it on tall bikes last year and took first freak class. There was a dude doing it on a 6-inch monkey bike, though. So if anyone won.
6-inch monkey bike.
6-inch wheels, yeah.
Oh, okay. The wheels.
Yeah.
I was like, a 6-inch tall bike?
Yeah. A little pocket bike.
Now that I would pay money to see.
Yeah. But I mean, there are lots of people doing that on like road bikes and just people that basically put in headphones and bang it out and however long.
We've gone a little bit long on this. I'd like to close out with some final words about bicycle clubs. So you are in the Dropouts and you've mentioned a few others. Do you have any words of advice or inspiration for people that are looking to join one?
Yeah. Well, if you have questions,
Dropout.com.
Dropoutbikeclub.com.
Who designed that wonderful website?
Christina Yvette Riot did a great job on that website. Maybe edit out the Yvette. But yeah, my advice would be come ride with us. Dropout rides every third Friday. We've been meeting at Colonel Summers Park for 13 years. We'll be there next Friday, April 20th. And feel free to ask us any questions or come to Zubom any Sunday night, rain or shine, every day, every Sunday, every year.
All right. Listeners, if you have any interest in this, what was that website again?
Dropoutbikeclub.com.
Dropoutbikeclub.com and or just, you know, Google bicycle clubs.
/ secret maps.
And now let's bring this to the table. Our topic today, massively multiplayer online role-playing games, a.k.a. MMOs. Ooh. Now, I've played a number of these. However, our special guest today, Christina, is what I consider something of a maven of MMOs.
Okay.
Take it away.
Well, let's see. I've been playing MMOs. Oh, gosh. Let me do the math. For about, 15 years
okay.
or so, a while. I don't know. When did EQ1 first come out?
That was more than 15 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, I didn't play EQ1, but I played, my first MMO was Dark Ages of Camelot.
Oh,
yeah.
You and me both.
Oh, yeah?
My
first was Anarchy Online, but Dark Age of Camelot was my second one.
Dark Age was my first.
My first was Ultima Online and then Anarchy Online.
That predates.
Yeah.
Ultima, I think, was one of the first.
90s.
Yeah. Ultima was like the first.
Yeah.
Well, I think there was the Guild and Meridian and all of those.
No, Guild is after Ultima.
What? Anyway, okay.
Okay. So,
We'll check this out later. But anyway, Christina.
So, Dark Ages of Camelot was my first. And that was popular at the same time the EQ1 was. They were in competition with each other.
I think it launched in, 2000, 2001, something like that?
I know. I was playing EQ on PS2 through their crappy modem in...
Oh, God.
It would have been in high school. So, it would have been somewhere around 2004, 2005.
We at Bikers, Dice, and Bars have nothing against console gaming.
Oh, man.
Oh, whoops.
But am I in the wrong room here?
Doesn't console.
I don't console.
I remember I was working back at an internet company in 2000, 2001 when Dark Age of Camelot came out. We had a big guild. So I think it was around that time. That game was amazing.
I loved that game. I played so much of that game. And that was actually my very first video gaming experience, really. I mean,
wait, what?
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I grew up with Nintendo and Atari and I played those games, but I didn't play those games. You know, it was just here and there. I wasn't a gamer or anything.
So it was your first exposure to a game that you were into.
That consumed me.
Something beyond go right or make the pieces
exactly,
fit together.
Yeah. Exactly. Something.
So let's get, wait. We got to frame up one important thing here. Dark Ages of Camelot, which was your kingdom?
Ooh, I played all of them.
Yeah,
oh,
me too.
Actually.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you were one of those people.
Yeah.
You were one of those. Okay.
But I think my favorite was the healer, and I think that may have been Midgard, but it's been so long.
Midgard, so
wouldn't every kingdom have had healers?
Each one did.
But there was a specific
I'm not familiar.
Healer. Class. You know, there's the druid, which I think maybe was
Hibernia.
Albion. Oh, it was
Hibernia. The druid was Hibernia. Yeah.
There was the druid.
The cleric
and
the cleric. Albion.
And then there was the healer,
which Midgard.
I think was Midgard. Yeah. And that was my favorite because I did human. I know. Seriously.
What do you got against humans, man?
You know, I'm either a human or an elf.
With Dark Age of Camelot, I played everything. But I interrupted you. You were saying it was your favorite because...
Well, it was my favorite because it was a really good balance of healing and controlling. And I really liked that. I really enjoyed, if you could control well enough, you would never have to heal.
You mean controlling magic on other players?
Crowd control kind of
stuff. Crowd control. Okay. Yeah. CC, Mike. CC.
Dude.
I liked the...
Click the buttons.
Clerics. And on the Albion, I ended up playing this cleric for a
Albion.
While. So Albion was my last choice because I started with Hibernia, then I moved to Midgard, and then to Albion. England. But then I realized I came up with a joke character, and my character's name was Youth Pastor Cody. So Dark Age of Camelot was one of the first games that let you program macros. And a macro let you assign a whole number of things to a single button. So you could assign an entire script that would pop up in chat whenever you press the button. So I changed all of my buttons to activate my abilities to a macro that would activate a prayer for the Righteous Extreme Youth Camp that I was the pastor of for Jesus, and then it would cast the spell. I was really, really good as a healer. I've always been good at support characters. So I got a reputation as being both really good and really annoying.
So were those are just popping up in the chat bar?
Yes. Or,
yeah.
People would hide me in chat if they grouped with me.
Nathaniel, there's a special slot in hell waiting for you. Mm-hmm. And I say that as a devout atheist.
Where does that go in my 10 slot bar?
10 slot bar.
So I'm now meeting in real life a chat spammer.
Yeah, it wasn't spam. Wow. I simply had a macro. So whenever
we get a reading from Chris from Riot over here?
No, that wasn't spam.
That's not spam. That's role play. Well,
if you know what, okay,
that's not
role
spam.
Playing.
Okay,
that's it just fair. Saved me the effort of having to type it every single time.
Yeah.
So I would always type out. I would have this macro that was like, "All right, kids, are you ready to get extreme for Jesus? Let's go!"
But he didn't have to have all that stuff in it.
No.
Yeah.
So, Christina, going back to that. So, Dark Ages of Camelot. Where'd you go from there?
So from there, I went to Star Wars Galaxies, and that game to date is my favorite MMO of all time. I loved that game. Talk about being consumed.
I don't think that game could exist today.
No, I don't think
it could. Because of the amount of player control and the number of trolls that we have on the internet today, that game would be destroyed within a week of launch.
It is entirely community run. I mean, it is player driven 100%. And that's what I loved about it, because I could control everything in my guild, and I could control my city, and it was amazing.
So you're a guild master.
Oh, I have been. Yes.
No,
I am not currently.
No, you are a guild master. I see it in you. In a day, you are. It is your nature. Even when we play our game on Monday nights, you're the guild master.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You're good at it.
I can be.
Yeah.
I can be.
I naturally feel the urge to check with you what we should do, because I'm like, she knows how to do this.
You know, right?
She knows how to do this, and I'm new. So
for anybody who doesn't know, we play this post-apocalyptic adventure / community simulator every Monday night at their house. And Christina has basically become the master of everything on the back end and does it very well. It's simply because I know that you have done guildmaster stuff for so long. We're very proud. Mm-hmm. You were very proud of what you did with that guild.
Oh, I took it so very seriously. I mean, when I ran my guild in Star Wars Galaxies, so I was an alpha.
Yeah, you were.
For Star Wars Galaxies. And that was back in the day when you had to apply. Like, you had to basically, it wasn't like, oh, post this on Twitter and sign up for our this account and blah, blah, blah. You had to apply. And it was just like applying for a job. They're like, what MMOs have you played? And, you know, what's your experience? And blah, blah, blah. And then you get chosen.
Now, for anybody who is unaware listening, what does alpha mean?
Oh, that is like, you know, when they're testing a game before they go live, there are a couple of different phases. You know, there's the alpha, which is before beta, obviously. And there's going to be a lot of bugs in the game, and they're looking for player feedback, you know, what needs improved, what are the glitches, and, you know, how is it playing? It's just a test run, basically. Mm-hmm. And so they want people who have played similar games before and who can give good feedback and you know, kind of know what to expect.
So what was your favorite race class in Star Wars Galaxies?
Oh, I was a combat medic, a Taris Kassi combat medic.
I'm noticing a theme.
Oh, yeah.
Always medic.
Always. Yeah. I'm always healer. A healer. Always.
So did you ever play Star Wars Old Republic? And what did you think about
it? Yes, and I did not like it. Because it was trying to be, I felt, a solo kind of adventure. You know, I think they were trying to cater to too many people. Mm-hmm. It was too broad, or, you know, like, you could have whatever experience you wanted, I guess. But, I don't know, it just didn't seem very player-driven or community-oriented.
And that is a topic that I wanted to get to in this conversation of the way that MMOs have changed from the way that we have been lovingly describing these games that we started with, and the different kind of communities and environments that we had then versus now, where every MMO in a post-WoW world, and WoW stands for World of Warcraft, if you are somehow unfamiliar with that term. In a post-WoW MMO world, everything's different. Everything has to cater towards the casual gamer and slowly build up everything towards the in-game raider. Whereas there was a time when we had MMOs that catered across the board, that had content from beginning to end, and that, believe it or not, did not have these things that we call raids. They were more community-driven. I do miss that.
Yeah.
But I do see the appeal for a company that wants to make in an MMO and make money in 2018.
Okay. I will say that, but I am going to point out that one of the most profitable MMOs of all time, and the one that is still nearest and dearest to my heart, EVE Online, is still rolling and kicking. I mean, it has...
Is it?
Oh, really? Yeah.
No. I tried EVE.
Oh.
I really did. I think that takes a special level of dedication and agoraphobia.
So what's the... I never saw EVE. What's the basic...
Anybody want to explain it?
Well, Jacob would probably be better because I really very briefly played it.
Spreadsheets in space.
Yeah, it is. It is very player driven. Probably, is it 100%?
It is not 100%. It has varied over the course of its lifetime between 40 and 20% developer driven, the rest of it player driven.
There are two video games that are out today that you will hear the most amazing stories from. And they are video games that are unapproachable by casual gamers. Those video games are EVE Online, which has like a 90-something percent player-driven universe, and Dwarf Fortress.
Well, I have not.
A single-player game with ASCII characters
that
is a complex community simulator where you send dwarves into the unknown and see what happens, and it's basically automated. So those two games have some of the most amazing post-game player stories online. And conversely, I don't know, there's a word here, but that word equates to them also being two of the most difficult to approach games as people who are new
as a casual genre,
as a casual gamer.
So, Christina, let's get the rundown on the rest of your curriculum vitae.
Okay. So Star Wars Galaxies, I played that for a few years. I actually was the mayor of, at one point, the largest guild across all servers, and there were over 500 people in that guild.
This does not surprise me,
Christina. We had the most Jedis, and it was insane. I mean, I was getting phone calls from our guild leader at work. At my real job, about, you know, things going on in our guild and things like that. And, you know, what are we going to do? And, you know, oh my gosh, we need to get more Jedi. And oh my gosh, we have to plan this. You know, they didn't have raids. There's no raids in Star Wars Galaxies. You'd take other people's bases. But anyway, so I did Star Wars Galaxies for a few years. And then I played EQ2 for a long time, very long time. I still dabble in that a little bit. I have introduced Mike to that.
And I've been trying to drag her back in there.
Yeah. It's just not the same. It really is not the same.
There's so much content there, though.
Well,
so
see, much content. And it's free. So much,
but how much of it is Grandy Quest?
No, EverQuest is great. See, the thing with me is that I'm not happy if I'm not running it. Like, I have to be in the management of the guild.
You. Yeah.
So... I just need to take a moment here. For those of you not on the mics, you don't have the pleasure of knowing the sheer awesomeness that is Christina's drive towards leadership and power. And I'm just going to point out that that statement right there encapsulates every time that Mike and I have turned to you during character development in a Monday night role-playing session and gone, so which of your characters is going to be the leader?
Yeah.
Not true.
See, that is so opposite of how I like to play, though. Like, you've seen, like, I'm constantly just ranger. Like, I don't really care that much about doing raids and stuff. I'll occasionally dabble, but like, I'd rather just be running around, like, seeing how much crap I can kite and kill by myself and be like, oh man, oh,
you
man.
Didn't even know what kite meant until
well, no,
last
I
week.
Didn't. Oh, whatever. I knew that longer than that, but anyway. But I did learn it from you.
I do want to talk about some of my favorite moments from MMOs. And these are the reasons why I keep coming back to them. So before I go into that, I'd like to talk about how I play MMOs and that I am constantly seeking an experience similar to the experience that I got from Dark Age of Camelot. And I know that, you know, if you're listening, you're probably going to be like, oh, that's just nostalgia. Dark Age of Camelot was a different experience. You weren't quest grinding. You were moving from area to area to find people to hang out with, to go hunt things. Mm-hmm. You weren't. That was it. That was the whole thing. Role playing and the hunt.
So, and you're forgetting control. Because,
oh, well, that's all the PvP stuff, which I'm going to get to that in a minute. The PvP stuff was its own other thing. But even just in your own realm, in the PvE areas, it wasn't quest hunting. Mm-hmm. You maybe had a handful of quests in an area and they were complex. They were like, go here, do this, do this, do this, do this. All right, you've solved the one quest.
Yeah, like an actual
they were a special treat.
They were a treat. Now, the reason that MMOs never quite satisfy me is it's simply, boom, you move to a quest hub. Mm-hmm. You get all the quests for that quest hub. Most of them are go destroy X number of things or gather X number of things, bring them back.
Or open up enough loot crates.
Or open up enough fucking loot crates, which we'll talk about in another episode because that's one of Xander's favorite topics.
I hate quests.
But yeah, the quests. But,
I hate them.
But, mm-hmm. but you can't get rid of them. They're right there on the screen. They're dinging up every time you walk. It's this whole addiction thing.
Well, and you can't get, you know, your special epic thing, you know, like an EverQuest too, for example. You know, you have your epic weapon that you really can't raid or do any major dungeons without, and you cannot get those things without questing.
But there's also, and that's because every game now has like 12 currencies. It used to be that your currency was copper, silver, gold, platinum, or something like that. Now it's soul gems, and every dungeon has its own currency. And then you can buy special magical crystal currency, and those equate to different things. Now, if you don't want to spend any money, because now they're all free to play, then you can grind copper. For every million copper you get, you can get a fraction of a soul currency, but you need 47 soul currencies to buy a bikini. And I'm like, what the
fuck? Yeah.
Or you can pay $5 real life money. And
I can say that's what I really loved about Star Wars Galaxies, because all of the epic shit that you wanted, you could make or have made for you,
right.
Which really created an interesting market, a player driven market. And let me say, you know, like, to be the most epic, you'd have to have a Jedi in your guild. And that's a person. That's not an item.
Right.
And so you would have to make your community attractive and offer these things, you know, to attract a Jedi to join your guild. And so you have guilds competing against each other to be the best, like really best, because they wanted to have Jedis in their guild. And, you know, and then to supply your Jedis with really awesome weapons, you'd have to farm crate dragons. And so then there's competition over the crate dragon spawns, and that created its own thing. And then to create certain other items that were epic, you have to farm. And so then there's competition on farming spots. You'd have to actually go out and survey and farm for these things. And there would only be this item in this area, and it changed every day, refreshed. And so you would have to get up. We would get up early in the morning before work and try and go and get the farm spot before other people did, because we got to put our harvester up because we got to harvest this resource because we got to make this awesome thing and we got to get there before our neighbors do. And then if they were there before us, then you're like, you got to fight them, you know, like it created like this real life, like territorial, mm-hmm. like you're protecting your territory. You're, you know, it's just, it was so many layers that no game provides today.
So Mike, before you take off, I just want to say crate dragons, huh?
Yeah.
So in other words, Star Wars Galaxies had the first loot crates.
Dragons. A couple of things. Yeah. So EQ is the one that I have the most experience with, I think, because I've played many, many hours of that. And yeah, it is a lot of quest grinding and whatnot. I don't find that it's very community driven. Like as a guild, what are you going to do other than, oh, who's level 100 and above? Okay, well, I guess we're going to go fight this giant thing. Like, we're just going to go raid this and we'll divvy up the armor. So yeah. there doesn't, other than getting things that are at the guild hall, I don't really see much of a reason to even be in one.
In the end, that is my problem with MMOs.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just, okay.
It's like, a grind.
And
it's a tiered weapon grind. You need to grind. I need to kill enough things to get the best gear so I can kill enough things to get the next best gear. But you don't even care about the grind. What you want is the highest level so then you can raid.
Yeah.
It's a grind to the raid. And for people today who play these MMOs who haven't been playing Dark Age of Camelot, who did not play Star Wars Galaxies, who have not played A Tale in the Desert, who have not played any of these heavy community-driven games, for them, the guild and the raid are one and the same, and there's no point in playing the game unless you are the highest level at the raid.
Yeah.
And that is the game for them.
So I believe, like, the goal is what is important. And if your goal is to have the best armor or have the most dragon heads from, you know, bosses slayed in raids, then play EQ2 or probably WoW or whatever. But for me, I am motivated by Empire and like being... being like
Walter White,
everything, like, and you can't do that in those games. I mean, you probably could, but it is a different experience. Like with Dark Ages of Camelot, the entire community was really brought together in the PvP, especially because, you know, you had to control that dungeon Darkness Falls to get, you know, access to special things. And you can only do that by winning the realm fight. So the entire server would come together to win this realm fall because you have a common goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, in EQ2 and other games, like there isn't a community goal. There are guild goals and there are personal goals, but there isn't a community goal. And same thing in Star Wars Galaxies. You create your own community goals by having alliances and different things like that. But anyway.
Yeah, something that I've noticed is, I mean, there is a crap ton. If you are willing to sit there and read scroll bars, there is a lot of storyline and lots of different little stories in EQ. But there's nothing really character or player driven.
Nobody reads it. People click.
Dude, I tried really hard, and I still do.
The same with Final Fantasy 14. That's like a one to read everything.
I read everything as much as I can, but there is just the sheer amount of those. Oh no, she clicks through.
I click through everything,
and it maddens me
because I want my own story. I want to make my own story.
But like, where's the balance between that and, forgive me for saying it, Second Life, which was the most player-driven thing I've ever seen.
Second Life is something that at some point we could probably go in.
I haven't seen it since like 2006 or 2007, but that shit was bizarre.
Before I hand off to Nathaniel to close us out here, as someone, and this is a call out to all my EVE Online buddies out there, as someone who remembers where they were when Vile'Rath died and was present for the memorial that we held for him, I just want to say, yeah, I mean, there's a big difference between MMORPGs that create community versus those that are just quest grinders.
So I'm going to close this out with a special shout out. First off, to everybody that I played Star Wars Galaxies with, it was an amazing game. second to everybody that played Anarchy Online with, where we built two different guilds
that
warred against each other in order for us to build story. Third, I want to build a shout out in Dark Age of Camelot to the Lurikeen Uprising. That was a special thing that happened. The carpet of level 15 Lurikeen that stormed the PvP lands and got slaughtered within a minute. I was there. But finally, I want to give a special shout out to that one guy who killed Lord British in a beta test conference in the middle of the game of Ultima Online. My heart goes out to you and my hat comes off to you.
One last thing. Where were you when Illidan was slain?
And now let's talk about booze. So, okay, first off, let's check in on the... I'm already slurring. My tongue is getting a little light in my mouth here, and that's because we've been drinking whiskey sours, and we're out. What do you guys think of these whiskey sours so far?
They could have been a little less sour.
No, I love them.
Yeah?
I like the sour.
You like the sour. Now,
I feel really like a little like soda water would have made it.
So you would have liked a little soda water. You would have liked to... You like them the way they are.
Oh, that was okay. You know, again, I already stated earlier that my preference or the whiskey sour that I am most used to is house whiskey on the gun with the sour. So,
and as far as I'm concerned, it appears that Miss Riot and I are both people who have bitter, bitter hearts.
Yes, indeed. And I have to point out that our special trip that we made to the store on the way here to get the cherries, you forgot the cherries.
Oh, no, I have the cherries.
It's a little late now.
We've finished
the whiskey. Who wants to eat maraschino cherries?
I want a fucking cherry in my whiskey.
You forgot the cherries.
You are from Alabama, aren't you, sir?
Well, you know what, son? I can be sometimes.
I got bings.
Yeah, he was adamant about stopping and getting the cherries.
I stopped
sir.
Yeah.
And then we forgot
sir.
Them.
I made us 15 minutes late for these.
Ladies and gentlemen, I need to take your attention for just a moment.
You had the cherries that won the Civil War, and you fed me this swill? Wait, that's a callback.
That's a callback. Mike, I challenge you to a duel.
What kind of duel?
We'll get to that.
Is that for bringing the cherries or
for getting the cherries?
Bada bing cherries are not cheap, shitty maraschino cherries.
Oh, no, I wouldn't bring that. Jesus.
Okay.
I hate maraschino cherries.
Cheap, all right.
Shitty, red. No.
Oh, my God. These are delicious.
Yeah, man. Get it. I would have brought Amarena, but I forgot to grab those.
Nathaniel,
like, if I had had another, half hour.
So, aside from the drink, our topic of the evening, Jacob.
Back of the house.
At a dive bar. The life of somebody who does not face the customers at the bar, but instead works behind the scenes, doing whatever it is that happens in the back of the house. Maybe you wash the dishes. Maybe you cook the food. Maybe you just sort of hang out and smoke a cigarette while somebody else does work, which from the places that I've worked, there usually is at least one person that seems to be their job because they've known the owner for 40 years. And that's, you know, that's their thing.
Sleeping
and you know
in
what?
The basement.
God bless them. Somebody needs to do it.
So, Mike, you work back of the house currently, and you have before. This is not your first rodeo.
This is absolutely not. I've been doing this for 14 years at this point. Yeah. So, I mean, I've done everything from very high volume at a cinema pub back in New Hampshire for 4 or 5 years. We were flat seating 600. So we were bringing in 600 people all at once, at least once a night, and then there would be a second seating, and all the food had to be out in like an hour and a half for all 600 people. And that was like my first cooking job ever, and that broke me of any fear of volume, of tickets, or work, or anything that I've ever had. And so I've done that. I've done like fine casual all over Portland for the last 8 years. And yeah, dive bars, fancy places in expensive neighborhoods, all over the place.
So I also have been around the block in the kitchen a time or two, as you and I have discussed. And we have both worked dive bars. When you walk into a job interview, how do you know that the back of house is a back of house of a dive bar? Because you can't always tell during the daytime unless the regulars are already propped up in the bar.
Well, that really... dive bar, another term that is just it's widely used these days to describe lots of places that I wouldn't necessarily consider a dive bar. Mm-hmm. Like a dive bar should have, for example, a shitty old carpet from the 70s that used to be that the orange color of this windscreen and is now just black and with hunks of you know, gum stamped into it, and people that look like they've been stamped into the carpet for the last 20 years too.
Mm-hmm.
usually a dirty old fryer that hasn't been changed in 5 years.
Right. You're waiting for it to erupt into flames any day now because of caked on crap.
Yeah, but that's
crap.
Part of the flavor, man. Like,
exactly.
That I have never worked in a place of that level. I've frequented those places and been like, hell yeah, give me your fried chicken out of that dirty old fryer because it's so good.
So you've never worked at Todd's?
No, I have never worked at Todd's.
Okay.
No.
I worked at a place that we were not even sure the deep fryer was actually made out of stainless steel until someone dropped a knife and it cut through the coating enough to see metal.
So, yeah, I've never worked in those places, but I know that level of filth, too. Like, I've worked in places where you'll be like, hey, when's you start there, and you're like, when's the last time you guys pulled out this oven? They're like, what do you mean pulled it out? And I'm like, okay, so...
When it comes to working towards that lower end of the bar kitchen spectrum, what are the challenges?
Again, I have standards myself. I'm like, I work at a place
somebody around here
that,
does.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily consider our food is elevated dive, I would say, where I work. Like, we make our own, we process our own meats in-house, which is like a lot more than I would expect of a shitty old place.
Wait. Jacob. Why would we bring this guy on again?
I'm not sure. I'm detecting some false representation. Yeah, in the
hey, man, you guys know where I work. You've been there.
Yeah,
you know, I've never been there.
So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, while we are not going to give away where Mike works, let me just say I will gladly go over there for a hamburger anytime. And their bartenders are... make me feel right at home because they're nice and beautiful and rude.
I love it. Yes.
That's kind of divey.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's very much a neighborhood place, which right. I guess in that respect, it's kind of more of a dive. Like you can tell when someone walks in and you're like, oh, that is not a regular.
They only came in because of the Yelp review.
Five guys in really nice suits are like, they don't know what they
yeah, walked into.
They don't know what this place is.
How long have you worked at your current job?
2 years and a month.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What do you like about working back of house?
I have a love-hate relationship with cooking that kind of, or with food, I'll say, that kind of swings because of how much of it I've handled.
I love food, but I need it.
There have been points, like when I started the job, that's I was like 18 years old and I was like, whatever, I'm making the same amount of money I would have made landscaping. But then I started to like really care about it and learn about how food works and about how to handle volume and how to produce large quantities of good food. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it just is so much that you stop looking at it as food. It just becomes a product. And then,
right.
you know, you'll either have a meal or make a recipe or read some or hear a story from another cook that like gets you back in the groove of caring about it.
Right.
And that's when like, I love being in that state, but I also love being crazy busy and just focusing on nothing other than like the flow.
You know, that kind of falls outside the scope of the conversation we're having here, but at some point I'd like to pull it back in and perhaps we can have a cooking corner where I'll bring on my friend Nancy, who's one of the sous over at Deschutes.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And the three of us can crash on that.
Okay.
So what is the biggest challenge about back of housing of a dive bar?
I think it's something about that relationship with having such a strong following of regulars that sometimes the line between employees and patrons can become a little blurred. And, you know, just the way that people's interpersonal relationships flow in a place where booze is the main currency, I guess. Well, or one of the main currencies. I don't know. It's interesting, especially now I've been fully enveloped in work friends and workplace and regulars in my past, but like as I've been drinking less and like hanging out outside less, I just kind of like I don't stay after work anymore like I used to, and it's nothing about the people or anything, but looking at it from the outside, it's really interesting how those things become blurred.
I definitely hear you there. You and I have the grease scars. You and I have the knife cuts. What I would like to hear from our two other people on the mics tonight is, when it comes to dive bars, what do you like about dive bar food?
Grease.
Grease is definitely an appeal for me, but also depending upon the bar. Sometimes you have that dive bar that has that rare, one in a million, amazing cook who has, there's this like old rugged dude at this bar who's just like living out the last days of his life, making the most goddamn amazing greasy food you've ever had in your life. So it's grease plus the rare experience of that one guy who just gets it.
Mini corn dogs.
Mini corn dogs. So, Mike, so I'm going to change the question for you. You've just worked that one of those obnoxious 12-hour plus shifts because somebody didn't show up. You got called in, even though you're full line, you ended up having to do prep work and shit, and you had to close down the house. It's the end of shift at any dive bar you've ever worked, and you're getting to tuck into your shift meal. What is it?
That's a tough one. I would have said 5 years ago, mac and cheese from scratch, I would have said. You start with hot oil, hot pan, garlic, deglaze with wine, crap ton of cream, reduce the hell out of it, throw a bunch of cheese in, and then the noodles. And just, like, just I don't know, hurt. Bacon, like, whatever wow. The hell else is awesome that's lying around.
Hold on.
Yeah.
NPC, quit masturbating.
That's
not dive bar food, man, but that's dude. Really good.
No, that is dive bar food. Oh. Seriously. No, seriously. That, let's say it's a place that does their noodles fresh. No, what I mean, does their noodles fresh, where they mean that they don't have them pre-boiled.
Okay, so you're actually dropping them.
Them. So if we're having to drop them in pasta water, that's what, 6 minutes tops?
It depends, but yeah, 6, 7, sometimes 8 minutes, depending on the noodle.
That is dive bar food. I've worked a lot of dive bars where we've had containers of cold noodles that have been cooked.
Yeah.
That we could just toss in the pan and let the sauce hit up. I mean, I think the one I worked at, which was called the Crowbar, we could turn out an entire order of mac and cheese in 3 minutes tops.
So in the past, I've been able to do it that way. Where I work now, rather than making it a pan, they don't like doing saute there. No one wants to saute, which is my favorite. So we don't do it like that. It's pre-made, mixed in noodles and sauce, and then baked for 15 minutes. They're always 15 minutes.
So I have to say that in my earlier days of work, I managed a restaurant and I had those 12-hour days where, as a manager, you are wearing all hats when you're super slammed and washing dishes or prepping or cooking or serving or cashing people out. You're doing everything. And my favorite meal was a triple-decker grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've never worked at what you would consider a dive bar. However, my entire career for the first 10 years of my working life was pizza places, several of which were pretty divey and had some shady management and had some shady customers and some shady people in the back. And I was always working in the back. And I worked with that one dude who was just always on a smoke break. And you're like, okay, well, something needs to happen. I'm smoking. You need to do it. But I remember the food. I just remember being able to make my own pizzas.
What
I appreciated.
Yeah.
Like working at these divey-ass pizza places that didn't give a shit led to me experimenting with pizza creation, led to me learning all of your dough recipes. So I can make them myself at home and not break your confidentiality agreements. But I have all of your dough recipes, and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And being able to make a pizza at home in with the things that I learned from working at these shitty places is amazing.
So important.
So important.
It's good to know how to make pan ordinaire.
Yeah.
I know how to make the dough from scratch. All I need is the base ingredients. I can't make the cheese from scratch because I'm just not that rustic and I don't have the time.
You need time and space, yeah.
Christina, by the way, I need to issue you an apology. I was not aware that you actually had worked below the grease line
At yes, a so- she worked at a soda fountain.
Well, I actually, so, okay, just real quick. When I was 19, 20 years old, I worked at a restaurant in Utah.
Oh.
So it wasn't a bar because there are no bars in Utah. There are only private clubs. Well, back then, I don't know how it is now. But I started as a fountaineer. It was a 50, it was a 50s diner. And I was a legit fountaineer and had the paper hat and everything. We had a full ice cream bar and I made old fashioned shakes. And then I was promoted to hostess and I wore a poodle skirt.
Oh, so Christina, I'm sorry.
Tell me more.
One day.
And, but listen, this is the funniest part is that in this particular 50s diner, we had a full jukebox. And anytime people would play tequila on the jukebox, we had to do the Pee Wee Herman dance at the soda fountain.
Oh,
the worst.
Yeah, it was terrible.
You are their
puppets.
It
was terrible. It was horrible, horrible, horrible.
I might even know, was it a chain?
Yes.
Because I think I worked for the same chain.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's interesting.
Maybe. Interesting. I worked for a very, very similar 50s style burger and shakes.
Well, they're only in Utah. In Arizona.
Have to do the tequila dance?
No, it wasn't the tequila, but they had other songs that if they were played, and they had tiny little jukeboxes at the table.
Oh, this is different.
Okay, yeah.
It was very similar, though. Not the same chain, I'm guessing, but I worked there, and I was a cook, and even the cooks had to come out and do a thing, and you know what?
Oh, not going to throw the that.
Yeah,
that
no, our place. Cooks didn't have to do that.
No. We can swear. We can swear. Fuck that. We can swear.
It's a podcast. I feel like someone had to ask that.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, Christina, I have to ask a question. As someone who's from the upper Midwest, where we hang on to cultural artifacts longer than most, when you made a Coca-Cola, were you taking syrup and adding soda?
All of our drinks were old fashioned, and we even had Coca-Cola Bell glasses. Those were our glasses. Yes, we used syrup. We used syrup, and we used syrup in all of our drinks. And we had cherry and lime and everything.
Any final words on working in the back of the house?
Don't do it for the money.
Do it for the what?
The stories.
Give us one story. Let's close this out with
what kind of story do you want?
Oh, give us a good one.
Oh. Story time, Uncle Mike. Story time.
I should have prepared a cooking story.
You'd be amazed.
Give me a prompt.
I'll give you a prompt. The new guy that reminded you of why you are still a cook.
Let's see. New guy stories. Okay. Well, it's not even a story. It's just a guy.
Go ahead.
That was just a continuing story. I'm not going to name his name.
Right. Don't do that. But the moment you realized that this guy was going to be that guy.
The one that I'm thinking of, classic encapsulation. He's holding a ladle. He's just got a ladle full of water one day. And he's standing over the fryer. And he's looking at the fryer. And he's looking at the ladle. And I'm just leaning against the prep table looking at him. It's like, don't do it. And he's looking at the fryer. And he's looking back at me. I'm like, you're going to have to clean that up. Looks at me, looks at the fryer, looks at the ladle, drops it right in there, spatters hot oil all over himself, everything around him for like a good 6-7 feet. That was like day in the life of that particular, let's call him Malone.
Yeah.
To Malone. Click. Sláinte. Click. There we go. Malone, we salute you.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
Well, we've been sitting here for God knows how long, and I think we're good and drunk by this point. And
with two special guests, Nathan.
With two special guests, and I must say, I am particularly sad that the Bada Bing cherries only came out towards the end.
Yeah, I really blew it there.
They would have made everything so much better. I've already had like two of them. I should not have any more.
Well, I'm leaving the jar, so.
So we've been drinking these whiskey sours. Now, these whiskey sours, again, were made with
with no Rebel cherries.
Well, they were made with no cherries, but we have Rebel Yell Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, handcrafted according to the original time-honored recipe since 1849. I'm curious, folks, now that we are at the end of our show, how drunk are you from this?
Christina.
I'm feeling pretty good. Yeah. although not quite as good as the last time I had whiskey.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Do you remember the last time?
I do remember the last time.
We were playing our Monday night
game.
Is
that when Suddenly Where's Christina?
Yeah, she's Suddenly Where's Christina?
So let's quick clear the air. Do I owe you an apology for last time?
No, as the that person, was my own fault.
As the person who brought the alcohol.
It was my own fault.
No, okay. Let's step back a little bit. Let's talk about our gaming group. So we've been gaming how long, Christina? You put this group together.
Oh, this group, 2 years-ish? A year and a half, 2 years?
I think we started in like July, a year and a half. Year and three quarters ago.
This July, it'll be 2 years.
Who was president?
Conchucho?
Was it Obama or Trump?
Oh, it was fucking Obama.
It was Obama. It was 2016.
Yeah. It's been almost 2 years, I think.
Yeah, I think it'll be 2 years in July or June.
Yeah, it will be.
It was the middle of summer.
For sure.
Christina came to me and said, I want to get a group. I want to introduce them to gaming. You're a pretty cool game master. I'm like, yeah, I am a pretty cool game master. So
now that we've pet NPC's ego.
I don't know if it went exactly like that, but okay.
It was something like that. The point is, you came to me.
I did.
And said, hey, I'm putting a game for these guys who've never played before. And it was a really interesting group of people, and it has evolved and changed, and we've moved locations since then. I like this group. This is a solid group. And we're playtesting a game that I was designing for Savage Worlds at the time. Motorcycles, Samurai.
I'm so mad I missed that.
Oh, it was really fun.
It was
fun. And now we're playing a post-apocalyptic. We're playing the American Survival Guide. It's a great
American
game.
American
Survival Guide.
Christina, you were the, as with so many things, both in and out of the game, you were the driving force to putting it together. I know you're going to demur on that, but too bad. So you found one of the better game masters in town in Nathaniel.
The best,
which you had prior experience with.
Yes, lots.
And for some reason, you decided to rope the guy you live in with it.
I believe I approached her, actually.
No, actually, I'll tell you what it was.
This is the story I've been wanting to hear.
Yes. I needed to make sure, before going any further with this guy, that he could game. Yeah. And that, you know, because this is something that's a part of my life and I like to do it. And, you know, and we had talked about it and he'd showed a little bit of interest. And so I was like, well, let's put something together.
Christina, roughly.
It was a litmus test. Yeah,
roughly, you and I are about the same age. So let me just endorse as someone else who's
been
around.
Early 20s, right?
Yeah, exactly. As someone who's been around the block in relationships, you got to make sure they're cool with gaming. Otherwise, the relationship's
not
dead.
Going to work.
Mike, you talked Christina into putting together this gaming group. And you guys had a couple members prior to when I joined. But I just want to say, I still remember my interview.
I do remember there being one.
I wasn't at the interview. You met with him at Guardian.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's right. So it was like meeting in a public place. Yeah.
So Nathaniel vaguely remembered me, as those of you who are longtime listeners to the podcast remember.
I want to cut you off for a moment to do a little bit of introduction to this. So the reason we even did an interview in the first place was because we'd had some people that just stopped showing up. And it was a little bit. It was a little bit intrusive to those of us who wanted to
which is totally reasonable.
Play a game. So we decided that if we're going to bring somebody in, we need to have somebody field them, and then the GM's going to interview them, or vice versa. The GM's going to field them, and then at least one of the players has to meet them and be like, look, this people is cool. We're going to bring them to my house kind of thing.
Right. And for all of you out there in Geekland, that is something I entirely recommend doing. That said,
always field your players. Yep. Go out with them, have a beer. If you cannot hang out with your player socially, you cannot game with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sorry. You know,
plus,
you may
blindly
think
bringing someone into your house.
Exactly. You may think that you can. I'm sorry. Again, we're going to go back to what we said last time. No gaming is better than
bad gaming.
Anyway, back to you.
I get the invitation to sit down for an interview, and it's framed like that, which I am not offended by. I totally endorse interviewing people you do not know personally before you invite them into your house and into your gaming group. So I'm hanging around Guardian when Mike shows up. Mike's sick. Mike's pale. Mike's running a fever. Mike's sweating like a meth addict.
I do not remember this. Oh my God.
Less than a couple minutes ago, Christina had to remind you that you were the one that interviewed me. So
just, wow. Must have been a great day.
Yeah. No, the interview lasted.
I think you were on Hebs.
In joke that we will explain at a later time. So you interviewed me and it was, yeah, you know what you're talking about. Yeah. Obviously, you're not a serial killer. You know what gaming's like. And you said something about showing up being important. Good. I'll see you next Monday. Bye. Oh, peace, bro.
See, yeah. I mean, I remember meeting you, but... yeah, I don't know. It's weird meeting people, like random people in public. And I was like, oh.
I could so tell you were sick. It was. You even said you weren't feeling good. So,
oh, man.
But yeah, so that's how the band got together.
So if I were the one doing the interview, so I can tell you, like, I take those interviews very seriously when I was a guild leader in Star Wars Galaxies. And
there were binders, as I understand.
Oh, yeah, I had real-life binders with all my stuff. Anyway, when I would interview somebody...
That's because you say blackmail information.
No. No, I'm organized. I take it very seriously. But when I would interview somebody to be a guild member... which isn't even coming into your home.
Right.
It's just on your screen. Mm-hmm. I invited them to my real life, or my, not my real life, my, I'm getting real life and virtual world mixed up. invited them to my little house in Star Wars Galaxies, into my my office. And
that's fucking amazing.
And I dressed up in my most finest robes.
That's amazing.
With my headdress, my interview headdress. And I had this ornate desk, and I sat, Jacob, my character sat behind the desk, and I had a little chair, chair, sitting in front of me, and in character, I would interview them like a job, and I had a list of questions, and so in real life, I actually had my binder that I would flip through with my questions and make notes in real life as I'm in character interviewing this person to be a member of my guild. So you're lucky that your interview was with this guy and not me.
And this is coming from World back in the day. Now you're running through an MMO and people are spamming to the public chat channels, membership for a guild. You can't run through any MMO now as a new player without fielding at least a dozen messages a month from people randomly just inviting you to their guild. You've never met this person. You're just a person who's running past. You do not have a guild membership under your name, which means they're going to spam an invite to you.
No, it was an honor.
Yes.
To be in my guild.
Back in the day, being in a guild was a thing.
It was a thing.
And we're going to close out on that. Being in a group, you should value that group. Be it your Absolutely. Gaming group, your bicycle club, your MMO guild, you should appreciate it.
Your Monday night game.
Or Absolutely. Your podcast crew.
Or
Monday night game.
Or your kitchen. Because, Mike, as you and I both know, nothing makes a kitchen night suck like having a noob who don't know shit.
All of always those be things, on time. All of those things are a team. You're on the team. You might not be on the active team at any one time, but you're a part of that group. And you should appreciate that. And they should appreciate you. If you're on a team that doesn't appreciate you, or if you don't appreciate your team, regardless of it being digital, tabletop, or in the kitchen, you should probably reconsider that at some point.
Because you might not be part of the team.
Exactly.
And knowing is half the battle. So let's go ahead and close out here. You've been listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. This is a podcast. We're still pretty early here, so we're kind of fitting our groove. I'm Nathaniel, your general arranger, producer, and host. Sitting to my left is...
Just Jacob. Normally sitting to my right would be Dr. Xander Gerrymander, but he's off tonight. And we're with our special guests,
Mike
and Christina,
who I suspect will be back again. Don't you agree, Nathaniel?
Oh, I think they'll be back. And did you guys have anything you wanted to promote really quick? If somebody wanted to follow you or your groups, if there's a website?
Yeah, ZubonPDX.net, I believe, and DropoutByClub.com.
Designed by?
In one case, Jacob Ryder, J-Ride, and Christina Riot for the DropoutByClub.com page.
And as always, we want to encourage you to keep the rubber side down.
Shiny side up.
Always tip your bartender. May your dice always roll criticals. And I think there was another one, but I forgot it.
Ride fast, take chances.
Ride fast, take chances. Life is lived in years. Living is measured in seconds.
And with that final bit of wisdom, thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. The Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Yep.